could even call it a son of Star Wars. It's this rebirth that we've seen of this very dangerous, very technologically unfeasible system to try and put a missile shield around the United States and hit incoming missiles with our missiles, and in essence, try and hit a bullet with a bullet as a means for preventing nuclear war.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, it's time for the Weekly Freak Show. Headlines and highlights for the week ending Wednesday, April 18th, 2001. My name's the V-Man, and I'll be your host for this half-hour look back at the news and features not heard in or glanced over by the corporate-controlled media. On this week's program, we'll be hearing from Jeremy Elkins on the struggle of teachers at the University of California to get a fair contract, and later, we'll be speaking with Matt Stembridge of Greenpeace about the Star Wars missile defense system. Plus, this week's Spotlight Sound. Stand by for the Weekly Freak Show, coming up next. And now, headlines for the week ending Wednesday, April 18th, 2001. 9 people were arrested on Friday, April 13th, after 5 activists locked themselves to earth-moving equipment along Highway 321 in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, to protest the Department of Transportation's expansion of the highway, which runs along the northern border of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. The project threatens to bury wetlands located along the boundary of the park. Since the Park Service has failed to do their job and protect our national treasure, it is up to citizens like us to block this illegal construction and demand a legal environmental impact statement, said Chris Irwin, one of the arrested protesters. According to activists with Earth First, the contractor, Charles Blaylock and Sons, is doing the maximum amount of damage before all requisite permits and permissions are obtained, and creeks in the area run brown from the expansion project. Trail guide Eric Placanis said, "Fragile wetlands are already impacted from clear-cutting and scouring of adjacent hillsides. Muddy runoff is choking endangered park streams." The arrested activists were charged with disorderly conduct, a misdemeanor, and bail was set at $5,000 each. On Monday, April 16th, about 1,500 people gathered in Klein Brogel, Belgium, for a nonviolent war crimes inspection. 850 activists non-violently entered the nuclear weapons base of Klein Brogel and tried to inspect the nuclear weapons deployed by the United States. This action was taken in hopes of bringing the nuclear weapons issue to a court of law. All 850 activists who crossed a fence at the base were arrested. Organizers claim it to be the biggest action on a nuclear weapons base in the history of the peace movement. Following on the heels of last week's boycott of Citibank, 2 activists unfurled a 20-foot banner outside Citigroup's headquarters in New York City on Monday, April 16th, during morning rush hour. The banner, which read, "Hey City, not with my money," was attempting to draw public attention to the growing controversy around Citi's leading role in financing environmentally and socially destructive projects around the globe. One of the climbers commented, "Citi has a consistent record of prioritizing short-term profits at the expense of long-term health of communities and the environment. I am here to send a clear message that Citi can no longer fund immoral and destructive activities with my money." Meanwhile, on Tuesday, shareholders attending Citigroup's shareholder meeting at Carnegie Hall were greeted by a lively protest demanding that Citigroup clean up its act on environmental and social abuses worldwide. No arrests were reported in either demonstration. During the traditional walk through the streets of Stockholm on Tuesday, April 17th, the Swedish finance minister, Bas Ringholm, was attacked by 2 members of the Stockholm Pie Brigade. The activists managed to throw not one, but 2 pies in the surprised minister's face. The aim of the attack was to protest against the increased neoliberal influence in the financial politics. According to a press release, the activists were hoping to draw attention to the forthcoming protests in Gothenburg against the so-called social democracy's neoliberal actions in Europe and globally. One of the 2 activists was seized by security officers and handed over to police, but was later released after identification. And finally, at press time, preparations are underway for this weekend's Summit of the Americas in Quebec City, Canada, to discuss the Free Trade Area of the Americas deal, which has been referred to by many activists as NAFTA on steroids. Thousands of protesters opposed to the talks are expected to descend on the city. Two activists traveling from New York City to Quebec were removed from a passenger train on Monday, April 16th, after being told, "You're not getting into Canada." Other passengers appeared to have been taken off the train as well, and the entire train seemed to be swarming with immigration agents and police. The activists were taken to an immigration office, where they were interrogated for over an hour, photographed, and had all their documents photographed as well. Some people have managed to make it into Quebec without difficulty. A group of Independent Media Center reporters crossed into Canada on the morning of the 18th. They were stopped, searched extensively, questioned, and one person was fingerprinted. Others, however, were not so lucky. A group from the Twin Cities Independent Media Center have been denied entry. Meanwhile, on Wednesday in Montreal, over 500 riot police were deployed in response to 75 protesters who blocked traffic and delivered caskets to a pre-FTAA cocktail party. There, transnational elites, including Mexican President Vicente Fox, socialized while discussing plans for implementing free trade agreements. The mood of the demonstration was somber as protesters laid down the coffins in front of hundreds of riot police. While the Summit of the Americas has symbolic importance for the free trade area of the Americas negotiation process, it is at private, off-the-record meetings such as this that privatization deals are negotiated and the true goals of the FTAA are advanced. For up-to-the-minute reports from these and other activities surrounding the FTAA and Summit of the Americas meeting, please visit the Quebec Center for Media Alternatives on the World Wide Web at www.quebec.indymedia.org. And those were headlines for the week ending Wednesday, April 18th, 2001. On Friday, April 13th, the American Federation of Teachers, or AFT, staged a rally on the campus of the University of California at Santa Cruz. University of California instructors are currently regarded as temporary employees, despite many instances of instructors working for decades or more in non-tenure-track positions. Instructors make up a large portion of the teaching corps at the various UCs. At UCSC, for example, they teach about half of the classes offered. They are required to undergo, among other things, a mandatory review every 3 years. If the review finds that their performance has been found less than excellent, they are terminated. Other tenure-track educators in the UC system are given merit raises if their reviews find them to be very good or excellent. In the whole UC system, instructors unionized by the AFT have been in contract negotiations for over a year and have been working without a contract for 8 months. Two of their major complaints are a lack of respect for their teaching and a lack of good faith bargaining by the university's administration. The instructors at this rally were educating a crowd of about 50 students, unionists, and interested passersby on their ongoing struggle to gain respect, job security, and improve learning conditions in the various UCs. Jeremy Elkins has been a full-time lecturer in legal studies at UCSC for 11 years and is also the statewide president of the UC American Federation of Teachers. He spoke with Freak Radio's fellow worker Will about the issues facing non-tenure track instructors.
Well, the sort of the big issue is just getting the university to concede that the non-Senate faculty or the non-tenure track faculty are an integral part of the teaching force. We teach about 50% of the courses, but the university administration still acts as though these people are basically temporary, filling in gaps for just a couple of years. So that's sort of the big issue. Specific issues, we're asking for workloads that will allow people to be able to actually devote time to students. Sometimes people are working now 70, 80 hours a week and don't have time to give the kind of attention to students that they deserve. We're talking about redoing a salary scale so that many non-Senate faculty members start at salaries $10,000 below high school teacher salaries. So we're talking about trying to get that up there so we can attract and retain the kind of people that students deserve to have teaching them. We're talking about getting some professional development funds so that people who are engaged in research or writing, exhibiting their work, can especially when it's related to their instruction, can have some support for doing that. Right now, when people do that, they do it totally on their own time and at their own expense. And again, that's part of recognizing that the faculty are real faculty and that they have real professional lives that we think benefit the students of the state. So those are sort of the big things. They're actually, everybody who's sort of not part of the university administration looks at those and says, that sounds really reasonable and modest. And they really are quite reasonable and modest. And we're really surprised that after a solid year of negotiations and 8 months without a contract, the university is still not seriously engaging with those issues.
Yeah, I think it seems particularly fallacious to me that people teach for decades at a time and still be considered temporary. It seems kind of true to form from my experience with the university as kind of the factory education system that was modeled by Charles Kerr. That is this just a University of California at Santa Cruz fight, or is this a UC-wide struggle?
This is a statewide UC-wide issue. It's the same problems everywhere in some campuses. You know, the problems are different in different departments. The pay scales are different in different places. But the basic issue goes throughout the system. This is the irony of it, is that non-Senate faculty or non-tenure track faculty are the only employees at UC who are required to be excellent. Not just to get a merit increase. There are other people who get merit increase if they're only very good. Our folks actually are terminated if they're not excellent. And so these are the people who are some of the best teachers at the UC campus. And what the administration continues to do is to treat them as though they're short-term and basically hold over this contract over their head. So if they say anything the university doesn't like, then they can be let go. And we have had, unfortunately, lots of cases in which some of them on this campus just about a year or two ago, in which people did speak out, go to the Academic Senate to raise issues, and the consequence was they found themselves terminated. So there really are important issues of academic freedom here as well.
Yeah, that's understandable. Have you gotten a lot of solidarity from other unions and from students and just general workers on campus? Or?
Yeah, we have. We're actually part of a coalition with other UC unions. We're doing a lot of work in the legislature on that. The University of California is widely acknowledged to be the single worst public employer in the state of California. Wow. And so we've been trying to reform that a bit. So we work with CNA, represents the nurses, with AFSCME, with Q, with AGSI, and with UPTI. And we're part of this coalition that's been trying to get the university to reform some of their practices in general. But we have lots of support for them for our particular issues as well.
Okay, and so would this action constitute the beginning of a strike, or are you still just trying to put pressure on them and bring them to the bargaining table with a reasonable mind frame?
Well, there certainly are lots of our members who are getting frustrated and are starting to call for that sort of thing. We are not ruling anything out. We certainly hope the university will be responsible enough that they can talk like adults about this and try to solve problems. And we have talked to the Senate folks, who all the ones that we've talked to are very supportive of our proposals. We've talked to the Senate leadership, and the university administration, who is not made up of academics, keeps on citing academic reasons for why they can't do this kind of stuff. So we're hoping that they're going to start talking more responsibly, but we are certainly starting to move more aggressively in the legislature, and we are thinking of, and we're certainly not in any way ruling out job actions, which we may see when school resumes in the fall if we don't get something taken care of very soon, maybe before that.
Okay, and how could somebody just who's not a member of these other unions that you're affiliated with show some solidarity with you folks? I know that a lot of students are probably really, really concerned about the quality of their education and recognize all the incredible labor that you guys do, but also members of the community. I myself am not a student, but I'm sure like myself and various of my friends and fellow workers would like to be able to show solidarity. So how could we do that?
Well, one of the University of California, because its Board of Governors is not elected, and that was one of the really sort of undemocratic aspects of it, doesn't respond that much to grassroots pressure, unfortunately. But we're going to use grassroots pressure and do what we can in that level. But at the same time, what we really need to do is to press them with Democratic representatives, and that means with the legislature. They're the ones who give the money, and they're the ones who keep telling us that the university should be held accountable. So the most important thing is to write letters to legislators or just call legislators' office and say, I really am concerned about what's going on up there at the university, to, for students to tell their parents what's going on so their parents can do that. But when legislators understand, as they're really beginning to understand, that the public really cares about this issue, there will be change, because they're the only ones now who really have the power. I mean, look, we can shut down classes, right? And that's one way of going, and that's one possibility. That's always our last resort, because we don't like to take it out on students, you know? So other than that, the way of doing it is by having the legislature, because they're really the only other folks who can put some pressure on the university to reform this and to say, we're not going to be giving you the money unless you tell us what you're doing with it. So that's the best way.
Okay. And if people want to find out more information about this, is there like a hotline or a website that they could go to?
They can. They can look at our website, which is www.cft.org, because we're part of the California Federation of Teachers. And if they just click on the UCAFT button, it'll go directly to our website. They can also, if they want to call, they can call area code 510-832-8812 and ask to talk to somebody there.
From the studios of Freak Radio, 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, you're listening to the Weekly Freak Show on WHUS, 91.7 FM in Storrs, Connecticut. Please stay tuned for contact information at the end of this half-hour broadcast. Up next, a discussion about the Star Wars program. Right after this week's Spotlight Sound, here's the Ramones with Please Don't Leave, an unreleased track from the End of the Century Sessions, dedicated in memory of Joey Ramone, who died of lymphoma on Sunday, April 15th.
You say you're gonna leave. You say you're gonna leave me, baby. Don't say you're gonna leave me. I'm begging, I'm begging, please. You say you're gonna leave. You say you're gonna leave me, baby. Don't say you're gonna leave me. I'm begging, I'm begging.
On Saturday, April 14th, more than 500 people gathered in London to protest British Prime Minister Tony Blair's support of the United States National Missile Defense System, also known as Star Wars, which requires the use of bases in the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, on Monday, demonstrators built a small fallout shelter outside U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein's San Francisco office to protest her support of the system. To get a better understanding about the Star Wars program, I spoke with Greenpeace International disarmament campaigner Matt Stembridge, who has been working out of the Washington, D.C. Greenpeace office since March. We discussed the basic elements of the National Missile Defense System.
Right now, the Star Wars,
as we call it, had its inception way back in the 40s. The U.S. government has been trying to come up with missile defense for a long time, and Star Wars itself came out of Ronald Reagan's speech Ronald Reagan made during his presidency, calling for the Strategic Defense Initiative, and it was dubbed Star Wars by critics and proponents alike. What we're calling Star Wars now is, you could even call it a son of Star Wars. It's this rebirth that we've seen of this very dangerous, very technologically unfeasible system to try and put a missile shield around the United States and hit incoming missiles with our missiles, and in essence, try and hit a bullet with a bullet as a means for preventing nuclear war. Where we're at right now is pretty much where we were at with the Reagan administration. There are a lot of plans out there. You'll hear plans being tossed around for a system based at sea, a system based in Alaska, a system based in space even. There are a lot of plans. There's a lot of money being spent on R&D here in the United States. And hopefully sometime this week, in fact, we will find out the next test date for the system that was proposed under the Clinton administration. And this next test will be the fourth in a series of interceptor tests. And the first three, two of them were absolute failures, and the other one worked merely by luck. And so in terms of where the program is at, a lot of money, like I said, in R&D, and not a whole lot to show for it. The Bush administration came in and did some pretty serious saber-rattling right off the bat with a visit by Secretary Rumsfeld to Munich. And then we've seen over and over again hints, if not outright statements, that the Bush administration is going to go ahead with NMD regardless of international or domestic resistance to it, of which there is a great amount. Even though this system hasn't been proven to work, the testing criteria that have been laid out have been called inadequate, even by former Pentagon testing officials. And then you have all sorts of questions about the diplomatic side of this as a way of trying to ensure peace by becoming more belligerent with this system.
Now, a lot of people would say that America needs this program. How do you feel about that?
Well, I would. I think the question is, when people say America needs this system, then what do we need it specifically for? You hear that we need it for these rogue states, but there are organizations out there on both sides of the political spectrum that discredit that. The CIA itself, in its own in a report, mentioned that the real threats to the U.S. They coined this three-word catchphrase: bugs, drugs, and thugs. None of which, we're talking about viruses, we're talking about terrorists, and we're talking about the narcotics trade. And the CIA itself did not come out and say that one of the three biggest threats are these rogue nations that could potentially, in a number of years far into the future, develop the capabilities and the intention of going to war with the United States using nuclear weapons. So when it comes to a question of need, what we don't need is this system that will push countries like China and Russia to modernize their weapons, to spend more money on defense, and to try and counteract this proposed fantasy system, and in fact make the world a more dangerous place. And there are other security measures out there that we could take. We could spend more money on the programs that have been successful so far to secure and immobilize weapons-grade plutonium in Russia, which is a major concern. We could spend more time and effort in diplomacy. There are all sorts of other things that we need much more than we need on the international front than we need with NMD. And in terms of domestic stuff, you take the $60 to $100 billion that this whole system is estimated to cost, and that's not necessarily even including the lifetime cost for operating these gigantic, crazy systems. And you wonder what we could do with that money here in the States for education, for health care, and so on.
So how would Star Wars or the National Missile Defense System affect the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty?
Well, from my understanding of it, Star Wars, that any deployment of Star Wars would violate the ABM, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. And it has been noted as the quote-unquote strategic cornerstone for weapons control by diplomats and ministers from a number of countries, including Russia. And they see it as a very important piece of the international arms agreement to keep intact and upon which to build further progress towards controlling and then reducing nuclear weapons. And so this system, if we deploy any part of it as it's currently proposed, would violate the ABM and risk freeing Russia to pursue its own ballistic missile defense system, and would just be a clear signal that the U.S. is no longer committed to reducing the threat of nuclear war.
Now, in terms of who is pushing for this, aside from government figures, George Bush, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, who stands to gain from this if this were enacted?
The dinosaur military defense industry. You've got your top four. You've got or the big four that are involved in this project: Boeing, TRW, Raytheon, and Lockheed Martin. Here in D.C., at least, it's really odd. I don't know if any of your listeners have seen this because of where you are on Santa Cruz, but around here there are ads sometimes at night on TV around the 11 o'clock news, or ads in the subway system here that sort of hint at how great NMD could be for the country, and there are ads being run by some of these companies and targeted at our decision makers right now. And so they stand to benefit quite a bit from contracts, not just the procurement contracts, actually buying the weaponry and the technology, but also just the immense amount of research and development that is going to need to be done over the next 5 to 10 years to try and make these systems work and iron out the kinks. And so you're talking billions of dollars, really, and that's who really stands to benefit from it.
Now, where were these tests that you referred to, the first three, two of which failed? They're based out of Vandenberg Air Force Base here in California.
The test is actually, it has two launch sites. It has the one in Vandenberg, which is where they launched the target vehicle, the missile that is supposed to represent or mimic the potential intercontinental ballistic missile threat from somewhere else. And then down in the Marshall Islands, in the middle of the Pacific, from a place called Kwajalein Atoll, from the Kwajalein Missile Range, they launched the KILL vehicle, which is the part of the whole program that is really receiving all of the research and development. And that is launched about 20 minutes after the launch happens in or at Vandenberg, attempts to fly at ridiculously high speed, something close to 15,000 miles an hour, to intercept the launch from Vandenberg. And that's where you get that analogy, hitting a bullet with a bullet. So that's how Vandenberg is related to all of this.
Now, coming up on May 19th, there's going to be massive demonstrations and protests there. What is Greenpeace doing to challenge this national missile defense system?
We are supporting those who will turn out for the May 19th event. We have our our flagship vessel, the Rainbow Warrior 2, down in the Marshall Islands right now to draw attention to the missile test that we expect to come up sometime in late spring or early summer. And we are down there trying to draw attention to the missile test right at the heart of the missile test. And we hope that efforts such as the Rainbow Warrior's presence in the Marshalls is able to complement the efforts of the local and international groups that are planning the May 19th event. We are also working with our members and with members of other organizations to reach out and let our elected officials know how dangerous and how foolhardy this whole system is, especially in Congress, letting our congressional members know that they have the public support to stand up and fight against this.
If you could just give our listeners a bit of contact information for Greenpeace and what they can do to oppose this plan, Star Wars.
Sure. You can call Greenpeace at 202-319-2404, or you can visit the webpage at www.greenpeaceusa.org. Both ways you can find out a lot more about Greenpeace as an organization, and then also our disarmament campaign.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening. The Weekly Freak Show is produced live in the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, and can also be heard on more than 15 non-commercial, micro-powered, community, and web-based radio stations, including Micropower 102.9 FM in Dade City, Florida. The interviews featured in this program are only a sample of the fine shows each week on Freak Radio. To hear it all, 24 hours a day, visit our website for instructions on how to hear the live stream at www.microradio.net/FRSC. Once again, that's www.microradio.net/FRSC. For questions and comments, send email to frsc@microradio.net. That's frsc@microradio.net. Or snail mail to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. That's P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. Or call area code 831-427-4523. That's 831-427-4523. Thanks to the A-Info's Radio Project and San Francisco Independent Media Center for distribution. Our theme music was arranged and performed by Neil Norman and his Cosmic Orchestra. For fellow worker Will and all the folks here at Freak Radio, my name's the V-Man, and that's a wrap.